I'm on two.
We're doing it live.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, welcome to Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz. I think we're just so full of candies and stuff that it's still affecting our, you know, general disposition, blood sugar, etc., but...
I literally forgot the number two because I was eating so much candy. I kept going one, three... Anyway, that's why we're
exactly,
spacing on the microphone
exactly,
number.
But hopefully we'll have it together right now.
Yes.
Now.
We do have a fairly important guest coming in, so we should get it together. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here for more of our little sketches on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading Open Sources on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today, we will talk about the terrorist attack in New York City on Tuesday. There was some pretty strong feelings shared in the immediate aftermath. But what about that other terrorist attack at the beginning of October? Then we will have an interview with Cambridge MPP and the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry, Catherine McGarry, and we're going to talk about library envy, her job in the provincial cabinet, and maybe why next year's election has her dancing a jig. I did read that in an op-ed in the Kitchener Record. So that'll be an interesting
moves, maybe.
Yes. maybe she'll show us how. But first, three people named Paul Manafort, Rick Gates, and George Papadopoulos are the first three casualties, so to speak, of the Mueller investigation. That's special prosecutor Robert Mueller, former FBI director and Trump's own personal boogeyman. I don't think it was the moment that the people who designed that that GIF of all the Trump people being arrested and rounded up.
It was at first I thought, it's happening. I was like, no, it's gorgeous.
You thought that was live footage?
Well, not live, but it was very convincing. I was like, this is very well done. I'm like, oh, it's not real.
It was from
Dreams Can Come True. No, I don't know.
It was I think it was from Daredevil.
It was
the Netflix Daredevil
award-winning stuff.
It was really good, and it's set to the tune of From Russia with Love by Whit Hightgrass. This is, you know, I think the message coming out of this is that these were the low-hanging fruit guys, and I've been listening to people who know these things talk about it. How for Manafort and Gates, who were primarily charged with money things outside of their work with the Trump campaign. I heard one U.S. attorney say that that's kind of the way these things operate, where they get you on the low-hanging fruit first, and then they bring in the other charges once they get that evidence going, and of course the hope is also to spook them. And I think the Trump administration was prepared for those guys to get rounded up. What they weren't prepared for was George Papadopoulos, who was either a high-ranking member of the foreign policy team of the Trump campaign or the water boy. It's
the low-level
depending on who you listen to.
Yeah. This is the thing. You squeeze the low-hanging fruit, and then you get the juice, and then...
Nice.
So it's true. I think Dan Rather called it the earthquake or the rumbling. Like, this could be the beginning. I wouldn't say of the end. Can't count Trump and company out yet. But it's not looking good. And this is how indictments like this work. As you said, Manafort and Gates, it was money laundering, acting as unregistered agents of the Ukraine, the former pro-Russian government of the Ukraine. There was a link there, which also establishes the other Russia link that's being investigated, and conspiracy against the U.S., which is large. Now, Papadopoulos took pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI as perjury, essentially. And he also, what is interesting out of this, in the release, how do they describe it? He's a proactive cooperator, and that usually means... Yeah, it's a bit of code, but it means that the person is generally wearing a wire or they're squawking, they're coughing up behind closed doors what wants to be heard or needs to be heard. And it's probably the only time Trump got very, very quiet.
Yeah.
When Papadopoulos.
Well, online
out.
Anyway.
Yes. Well, at least, well, Trump is his, or Trump, Twitter is Trump's mouthpiece. But or sounding board, we'll call it. Mm-hmm. But, and then, of course, once the terrorist attack happened, which we're going to talk about in a bit, that he piped in again, as, you know, you would hope a president would do, mind you, not in his style. So, yeah, exactly. So, anyway, yes, it starts with these guys. Now, this what's interesting is this is indictment B. And I'm actually, it's not out yet who indictment A is.
Yeah, that was weird.
So who is indictment A? That's another lingering kind of, when is that going to drop?
But of course, that adds
an air of mystery.
Of course, there's been a lot of accusations that Mueller's team's been leaking like a sieve with like all these developments and things.
Is that intentional, though? Like,
well, I mean, that's an accusation that all the details that have been coming out of this have been from the Mueller side, a.k.a. the prosecuting of Trump, the witch hunt side of things.
Right. It's all lies, of course.
But Papadopoulos was arrested at the end of July. I think it was July 28th. And nobody knew that they had him arrested and that he was, I forget the term you said, but that was so great, but that he was had been turned, and this was like 5 months ago. Nobody knew this until the indictment dropped on Monday. So there's no way that the Mueller team is sitting on that and then leaking on all these little things. There's no way.
No. So it's indicative that there's more. There's definitely more. And it's the kind of thing, we were talking about this, and the comparison was to Al Capone. They didn't get Al Capone on all the other stuff he did. They got him on tax evasion. So it's like you go in with this, and it's bad. I mean, this alone, aside from the we've been calling it Trump Russia, which is technically what Trump campaign / Russia, we should call it. They're calling it garden variety money laundering, but it's big bucks. $1 million through the local antique rug shop. Like, some of the stuff just seems ridiculous.
Three passports.
See, there you go. That's like that should charge on unto itself. If it was Joe Schmo, you'd be going down just for that, right? But in the scheme of things, though, it's kind of in the scheme of the moneyed class, this is small potatoes, really. I mean, this kind of stuff is going on all the time. We've seen it with the Panama Papers. We've seen it from this. It's one of those things that, well, it's not okay, but they consider it okay until they get caught. Sarah Saunders, who's dropped the Huckabee, seems no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion. There's nothing in the indictment that changes that. Everybody's like they're sticking with the program and saying there's nothing in this that indicates that there's a problem. Until, like, the pictures come out of all of them sitting around the table, the mystery man Papadopoulos that nobody seems to know about is at the meeting. And supposedly it's the meeting where he said, I think I can get you an audience with Putin.
Right.
Supposedly.
Well, that's
Jeff
the
Sessions
rumor.
Was there.
Yeah.
They're all there. Supposedly he has testified to this. I believe that was the story. Now, Trump is there. All of the people named and all of this are all at this meeting. Is that the... And it's like any... It's almost like a stock photo of a meeting. It was like, okay, we're having a meeting. Where's the pizza? Or whatever, right? But it could shape up to be a very significant picture. So, yeah, the federal agents are all over this.
Right. That's the most damning thing about the Papadopoulos thing is that he's sitting there at that meeting with Sessions.
But we don't know him.
He's sitting there at that meeting
exactly.
with Sessions, and then as you said, this is the supposed meeting where he said, by the way, I got connections to Putin, you know, if you want to want me to hook you up or
that's
something
fantastic.
And of course Jeff Sessions famously said that he had no knowledge of anyone colluding with Russians that was involved in the Trump campaign. That was back in January at his confirmation hearing, which means that if that meeting happened exactly as the way it's been reported, that he lied. He perjured himself in front of the Senate because there was somebody who was pitching collusion at that meeting. And oddly enough, it was someone who was working under, maybe not directly under Jeff Sessions, but definitely under his branch of the campaign, because Jeff Sessions was the main foreign policy advisor for the Trump campaign. So that looks terrible. And then on top of all this, because I do want to address this too, they had the heads of Google, Twitter, and Facebook in front of the Senate. Not the Senate, the Congressional Intelligence Committee this week. And they released all this, all these examples of Russian propaganda. And
the Russians know their propaganda.
There was apparently two sides who were promoting two different actors who were promoting an anti-Islam event and a pro-Islam event on the same day in Houston in May 2016. And they were both Russian agents, and they were both trying to stoke Islamophobic sentiment and you know, in more, you know, centrist, diverse, friendly sentiment in the Houston area. But, you know, there was no American actors involved in any of these things. So you're picturing people going to this protest like, hey, where's Jimmy from?
He said he'd be here.
From Austin. He was one of the organizers from this. And Jimmy from Austin's, you know, actually, you know, Alexei from St. Petersburg.
Yeah. He didn't click interested. He clicked going, but then he didn't go.
That's
how it works, right?
Classic
I'm
move.
Go to this event. I'm going to go to the anti-one and the pro-one at the same time.
Classic
now,
move.
Were these guys posing as Americans? Or
Yeah, they were posing as, like, local Houston area. Like,
oh.
And one guy be like, we got to do something about these Muslims. And the other guy be like, you know what?
Peace
Muslims are our neighbors.
Yeah.
We should be friends. And then they would attract, you know, agitators from
the
both sides.
Suspects.
And then they would say, we're going to do this thing at this time on this day in Houston. Come on in. And then everybody gets there. And, you know, the kind of the organizers of this quote-unquote debate are nowhere to be found because they don't exist, at least in an American sense. So that was crazy thing number one.
Virtual agitators, yeah.
Right. The crazy thing number two was that Twitter, in one of its sort of Band-Aid responses recently, stopped accepting ads from Russia Today and Sputnik, being that they recognize both organizations as propaganda wings of the Kremlin. Mm. But Twitter was pitching Russia Today to spend $3 million in advertising during the 2016 election campaign.
Hmm.
And then on top of all this, you have, I can't remember, I think it was the guy from Facebook who was like saying, it wasn't Zuckerberg, it was like one of the business guys saying like,
Schmuckerberg.
Like, we're not creating the content here.
Yeah, the usual.
Which is...
But give us your money and we'll do your bidding, right?
Right.
It's just information, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Which, I mean, I think we're kind of past that point where these guys can claim to be innocent players in all this. They aren't creating content, but they are certainly aggregating content because there are all sorts of algorithms involved. And, you know, you like Tim Burton movies, you're going to see a lot of Tim Burton movie-related news come up on your feed. Or you like horror movies. If you like the last Conjuring movie, let's say, you're going to see a lot more horror movie-related stuff come up. So it's just, you know, it's axiomatic. You're going to go on Facebook, you're going to talk about, you know, liberals destroying America and how you're pro-Trump.
Yeah.
You can start tailoring stuff that way, and it seems like it's such a... There's such a lack of responsibility on Facebook's part that they've rigged the game to deliver things
sure.
that you like and then to say, well, we're not to blame.
And I've also found that there's like sub things on Facebook where I was looking at some like an obscure French band on YouTube and then something came up in my Facebook feed and I'm clear the cache, clear the history, clear everything, clear it all, right? It doesn't clear at all. Like you're gonna get concentrated content because somewhere there's a server with the info on it. So
yeah,
that sounded super conspiratorial. But
you can't clear the cache at Facebook.
Can't clear the cache at all, even though. But yeah, so that's something to be mindful of, folks. That's almost like your tech tip for today. It's like watch where you're surfing. But there's a three other two sort of. Not a bit of an aside, but to go back to the cases that the sort of attacking Manafort's foreign income and all the laundering of money is a bit of a test case in that if they want to nail Trump on something, not necessarily impeachment wise, they can go after his foreign revenue dealings if those aren't square. What would be an example, you know, if the T's aren't all crossed and the I's all dotted on the golf courses in Scotland or wherever else he has hotels or where he sends his son and whomever and son-in-law. And of course, there was the famous meeting. This is like another meeting, the other meeting that was talked about when Kushner, Trump Jr. and Manafort went to meet with that What was she called? It was like it was to do with orphans, but it was probably
It was about the Magnitsky Act.
Something else. Yeah,
yeah, and of course, as people have noted, that you know, working for the Foreign Office has been a long time, you know, cover job for a spy because it involves a lot of travel and diplomatic papers and
low level, just does low level stuff.
So yeah, and of course,
my coffee.
And of course, there was meetings with like Kislyak, who of course, I think I've said this before, but Kislyak's like the second most famous spy in the world after James Bond. So there's a lot of. I mean, there's a lot of slime here. And, of course, maybe the most damning thing is I think it was one of Gabe Sherman's scoops for Vanity Fair, but he noted that Trump's ire has been turning towards Jared because he's hearing the siren call of Steve Bannon and the likes who are saying, like, Jared Kushner is the worst political advisor in the history of the White House. It's like, yeah, because he has no political advisor experience. But
that's neither here nor there. Right?
Well, yeah. There's that, too. Yeah. But it's just, it seems so, like, seems so weird. But on top of all this is that if Trump really is, like, sort of targeting his son-in-law for some of his, like, maybe viciousness. And Jared's being given a good, hard look at because apparently he was one of the key advisors that said, fire Comey, which leads to all the obstruction stuff. But if there was one person in the White House who was almost assuredly safe from Trump's wrath, it was probably Jared. Mm-hmm. But if Jared's not safe...
No one is safe.
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, no one was really safe, but if Jared isn't safe, really, really no one is safe.
It's like worthy of Shakespeare.
Or
House of Cards, which is based on Shakespeare pretty much. I don't know if anybody's going to watch anymore, but that's another story.
Let me say this from my life as another movie reviewer, as a movie reviewer. If they put this in like a Netflix miniseries.
Oh, top.
I would say this is complete and utter horse you know what? Like, this is completely and totally unbelievable because this outdoes House of Cards.
Oh, yeah.
Which has its own separate issues, which we won't get into
yes,
right now.
Yes, maybe one day.
More sad news out of New York. A terrorist attack. Uzbekistan immigrant by the name of Saifullo Saipov. I believe that is how you pronounce his name.
I think so.
But he rented a truck from Home Depot and drove it into Lower Manhattan, where he aimed at a bunch of people riding their bikes, walking around on what looked like a very nice New York day, Halloween too, and killed 8, injured another dozen or so people. I was watching the coverage on Halloween night. I actually slept through this because I was working overnight at my day job.
This guy just goes, people. So go.
So I woke up and this was on, and I was like, "Holy!"
Just when you think the biggest news story is out, then
exactly. But I was watching the news coverage on CNN, and they showed a picture of the Empire State Building in red, white, and I think it was the Freedom Tower. The Antenna of the Freedom Tower was lit up red, white, and blue. And the anchor was like some effective, well, it's red, white, and blue because today there was an attack on our freedom and democracy. And I was like, interesting. Here we have a guy who killed 8 people with a truck. And the months began with a guy that killed 50 people, injuring 500 more with a gun.
Yeah.
What's the difference between these two events that we're so willing to call the one terror?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that to do is with the fact that the guy lived, and also the way he looks. He's got the standard terror look. Send him to Gitmo.
He's got the terror beard.
They're tapping into that whole the other thing, which is there is that the channel that they turn into essentially, where it's like, yeah, let's beat on Muslims and Islam again. This guy sounds like the usual. Radicalized, and they spoke to an imam. They spoke to an imam, and the imam's like, "No, this guy was sort of down on us, saying, 'No, you don't embrace real Islam.' It's the usual stuff, right?" Mm-hmm. And they said that this attack was, ISIS MO to a T. You know, it's their patented using their techniques. Like they have a magazine, they have an online magazine.
They have an English language magazine.
Yeah, they go and say, okay, just do this and rent a truck and horrible stuff. But it's like,
yeah, that was a piece of advice. It's like, don't get a car, get a truck. More casualties, which is and if you boggles the mind that someone would write that down.
Yeah, but that's this is how they roll, right? And of course, this guy was also embracing the symbolism. Okay, it's Halloween. There's going to be a lot of people out. Got on the bike lane, which is, I don't know if you've ever been to this part of New York. It's actually quite nice. A couple times I've been, we stayed just further up. The High Line Park is there, and it's really well laid out. Bike lane, thousands of people use it a day. And, of course, he's gunning it down towards Ground Zero, right? So he's trying to embrace all of these, the symbols. And speaking of symbols of a sort, Trump's deflection on this was the whole blaming the Chuck Schumer initiated program, getting, I think it's something like 55,000 visas to immigrants that aren't necessarily qualified. It was just like, there's a lottery. This guy's right. One of the ones that won the lottery however many years ago. I think it was 2010.
It's from, countries that don't normally see a lot of, that America sees a lot of immigration from, which would include Uzbekistan.
Yes, definitely. So it was to kind of mix it up a bit. And that law had, at the time, had not universal support, but support on both sides. Support on many sides, including Bush. Bush, H.W. Bush. Yeah. Bush Dad signed it into
Bush Dad.
Bush Dad. Papa Bush.
Sounds like a sitcom.
Grabber,
Bush
signed
Dad.
It into law. So, it's not as if this was just a strictly Democrat initiative. But, of course, Trump is playing the political card on that as well. It's like, send him. He's at the table, like, send him to Gitmo.
Oh, my goodness.
Who knows if he gets shot in the abdomen? I mean, who knows if he'll even live? But
well, he seems to be recovering.
Sounds
fine.
Like it, but
that he's recovered enough to sort of waive his Miranda rights to remain silent. And
yeah, and he's doing this weird stuff. Like they were talking to him, he's like he felt great about what he had done. And the weird, really weird, was that he requested if he could put a couple of ISIS flags up in the hospital room.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Secret Service and those guys do when somebody says something like that, but it must be really, really hard for them not to get him by the throat.
Yeah.
For sure. So
he's either ballsy or crazy. It's really hard to tell.
It's probably both. but it's one of those things where, I don't know, it just keeps happening.
Yeah, I think the weird part in this is that he doesn't speak Arabic, but he went to the trouble of finding someone who was able to write Arabic so he could write like ISIS endures or something on little notes to leave at the scene. I think he also had he didn't have guns with him. Yes. But he had like cap guns or something, paintball guns,
a pellet gun.
And I heard some security expert speculate that was so it would be like suicide by cop.
Yeah.
Which
Ooh,
I guess
he's got a gun. Shoot him.
Yeah. Which I guess is like maybe a kind of suicide attack.
And he had a bunch of knives too, which is also typical of.
But they know. But it was also noted that despite all the ISIS stuff, that ISIS hasn't taken credit for this. And somebody observed that typically ISIS will immediately take credit for something if the perpetrator is dead, because no one else is there to say otherwise. So I guess maybe this guy being alive and talking about putting ISIS flags up in his hospital room is like maybe enough of a statement for the actual real Islamic State to not issue a press release or something.
Islamic State, I mean, maybe they're getting pretty padded,
maybe it'll be a feature in the next ISIS magazine.
ISIS magazine. I was curious about that. I can't bring myself to Google it or look at it on a computer simply because that this is
you end up on a list.
Ooh, he's looking at the ISIS magazine. Yeah.
If you end up on a list for liking some obscure French band.
Yeah. I'm hoping maybe somebody knows out there. There's like a version of the ISIS magazine that's filtered through somebody else. Then I would like sell on or something. We'll probably have excerpts or something just to see.
Yeah, maybe someone who
curiosity is. I can't do it.
VPN access or something. A secure server.
Maybe we'll find that. I don't know. And if you know, let us know, because I'm definitely not Googling it straight. That's for sure. Nor should you.
No.
But yeah, and there's also what else going on. Do you hear anything today? Because I'm a little bit behind about there was a second man. They're looking for this. They always seem to be the second or the third man in this.
Well, there must be someone else if he.
Maybe the guy that wrote the Arabic notes.
I imagine that's who they're looking for. Yeah. I unfortunately, I'm a bit behind myself today. running around. But the last I heard, yeah, they were looking for a second person to question them, not necessarily to arrest.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, we saw this happen with the Las Vegas shooter too, that they were looking for somebody who could lend insight into what was going on in that guy's head.
And they started with his wife, right? But
yeah.
So anyway, Saipov was charged with two things, and I'm not sure if this charge is post 9/11 violence and destruction of a motor vehicle. I may have gotten that wrong, maybe with a motor vehicle, but it sounds like a post 9/11 law. And I'm sure, you know, there's obviously laws involving people hitting other people with cars at some point, usually impaired. But the other one was material support to terrorists, right? So
that's
when it became terror law.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it would have been, had he lived, it would have been difficult to charge the Vegas shooter with that, I suppose.
Well, I mean,
we get him on a terror charge.
The thing I will note about the Vegas shooter
gun
is
charging.
Right, but the thing I will note about the Vegas shooter is that we don't know why he did it. Still,
no, may never know.
We may never know.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's kind of problem number one. I understand the distinction that, you know, when you're talking about terrorism, someone's doing it to make a violent political point, and we don't know why the Vegas shooter is. My thing about this was, 500 shot, 50 killed. We may never know, and that's okay. We're not going to do anything. This guy kills 8, injures a dozen, and we're talking about walls. We're talking about extreme vetting. We're talking about sending people to Gitmo again.
Yeah.
We're talking about immigration bans. We're talking about, how the American legal system is slow, and we got to treat these animals as badly as they treat. And Rachel Maddow made the point last night on her show that the American legal system has batted 1,000 so far in terms of putting terrorists in jail. No terrorist, no alleged terrorist has ever gotten away on a technicality or anything.
No.
Which is, you can hardly say the same thing about some of the worst crime bosses in American criminal history either. The American legal system is like maybe bats 500, 600 on that.
Yeah, you have to get them on tax evasion.
Exactly. So, that's where this kind of gets really problematic. And for Donald Trump to sort of shoot off from the mountain and start calling someone who's alleged, because, you're still innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. We may have seen him on, iPhone video running from the scene and again getting shot by the police and all that. But you're still innocent until proven guilty. So when the president of the United States comes out and calls you an animal and says you should be executed, and that was the thing he did today I did keep up on, that Trump rolled back his accusations that the American legal system sucks, but stayed firm on the notion that this man be executed. I'm not sure whether he meant if he was found guilty before he was found guilty in a court of law. Who knows with Donald Trump. But that's the problem with that situation, is that you have the president automatically casting guilt. And despite who's the president right now, the word of the president of the United States carries a lot of weight. And the last time this happened, oddly enough, was with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon got up in front of the White House press corps and talked about how Charles Manson needed to be put away and put down, and which Charles Manson then quickly turned into a prop during his trial. Mm-hmm. So,
he did the old, I didn't actually kill anybody, right? Yeah, but
right. So, Manson, I mean, again, so presidents have to be really, really careful and cautious and not to politicize this, which is, of course, not in Donald Trump's nature. And that's problematic on top of the other things, like sending him to Gitmo, which has
to be empty and closed by this point.
Which
right?
is a completely made up kangaroo court that apparently can't even get the court right in the kangarooism of it. Yeah. And then I'll finish off by saying, I saw on the news, everyone was reporting that as he got out of the truck, Saipov said, Allah Akbar, God is great, which of course is the rallying cry for Islamic extremist terrorists. I don't know what Dylann Roof said before he shot all those people in South Carolina at a black church there. That's just another distinction, I think. You say Allah Akbar, you're automatically going to get people mad. But if you're a white guy and you shoot, a dozen black people, out of racist reasons, no one notes what you said before shots were fired. So
it all depends whether you're a card-carrying member of the NRA, I believe. Just my view. But
anyway,
sad but true.
We're gonna try and We're going to try and take things up in a more positive direction as we sit down with MPP Catherine McGarry. That's coming up next. Before that, we got some music and some PSAs. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Was the Lemon Bucket Orchestra from their new album, what is it called? If I Had the Strength. They are going to be the opening act and band at the Guelph Film Festival, although not in a film, they'll be here in person, November 10th to 18th. More information on that, check out guelphfilmfestival.ca. Always a good time.
I am the official voice of the Guelph, at least CFRU.
Yeah, I am. See if we can dig that up before we go.
Yeah, the film festival is teaming up music and films this year. There's a couple of different, I guess they're super tickets where you can check that out.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool. It's also cool to have a real-life provincial cabinet minister here with us today. Catherine McGarry is the MPP of Cambridge and is also known to some as the Minister of Wood, but known to others as the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry. It's so great to have you here, Minister McGarry. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
We ought to explain that a little. We were talking before the commercial, the Minister of Wood, because you were in the distillery just yesterday. Part of your duties was watching them erect the 50-foot Christmas tree there.
Yeah, it's actually the most photographed tree, they think, in Ontario. But it sets off the Christmas season, and we are trying to promote Christmas Tree Day and having people go out and choose a live tree for Christmas. Mm-hmm. So this was a wonderful example. It was from Huntsville, so Ontario Wood, look for the leaf logo. And it's a 50-foot white spruce tree, and I have to tell you, they had 43,000 lights lined up to go on it.
Oh, wow.
Almost 2 kilometers of ribbon.
Oh, wow.
And 800,000 Christmas poles to decorate this.
Gosh.
Takes them 5 days. I would say that most families don't spend that amount of time, but
no.
Buying a real Christmas tree gives thousands of people work.
Mm.
It's good for our local farmers. A sustainable crop, as I like to say, and all natural and 100% biodegradable. So we kicked off the season, even though it was the day after Halloween.
Earlier, I think, every year, right?
Well, you can't really go too much further before you start overlapping Halloween, but Lord knows the retailers are trying. It is interesting, that point, that we don't typically think of trees as a crop, and we don't really, mm-hmm. when we talk about Christmas... Christmas trees, you know, I think we talk about the convenience of, you know, the plastic tree and the ones that already have the lights on them and all that. We don't think of Christmas trees as an Ontario industry and as something that is supporting Ontario jobs and that sort of thing.
And it's really interesting. Our forestry sector supports 172,000 direct and indirect jobs across 260 communities in Ontario. Mm. Most people think of it as a northern industry, but it's across the province. And we have local Christmas tree farms right here in Waterloo, Wellington areas, which encourage people to go out and cut down those trees. But for every tree harvested... Mm-hmm. 3 grow in its stead.
Right.
And growing trees are great for removing carbon out of the air and sustainable jobs.
Yeah, that's... I guess I didn't realize that was a provincial mandate. When you take out one, you put in 3. Because I know covering city council, when a development comes forward and they have to remove trees, they take out one, they have to put 3
well,
more in the ground.
Well, for our industry sector, they have to plant 3. But mm-hmm. the Urban Tree Program has benefited from our 50 million tree challenge that we launched in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2025, our goal is to have 50 million trees planted. Now, that's not the industry. That is farmers. It's anybody with 2.5 hectares of land. This year, we launched the Green Leaf Challenge. So we have challenged anybody that wants to plant a tree to do so on their property, no matter how big it is. And we have we want it doubled this year. So we don't have the final count yet. But if you've planted a tree on your property, your business, or you're in a school, there's an interactive map on my ministry site, greenleafchallenge.ca, and you can just point and click and add your tree.
Cool.
It's a great program. I've done schools, homes, businesses. We've gone out to ensure that people are planting it. And that's great for the cities. And you're quite right. There's a huge focus right now on climate change mitigation and adaptation measures. And one of those things is planting more trees.
And it's very non-political, too. But nobody really objects to the planting of trees.
No, not at all. And it's a legacy program. I mean, this year, many schools have planted something in their stead. And to celebrate Ontario and Canada, their 150th birthday, many people are erecting trees and feeling good about that.
Well, if I can revisit Guelph for a minute, I know that there was a capital budget discussion last week at City Hall. And Cambridge came up because there's a lot of what I'm calling library envy because of the idea exchange in Cambridge. There's a lot of library envy in Guelph.
Have you seen the plans, Adam?
I have seen the plans. Ooh, I've seen the video.
The video is fabulous.
So, you know, perhaps for some of the Guelphites out there, and I know that there has been some provincial involvement in getting the idea exchange going. But in terms of how that sort of has come to reality, from your knowledge, how can maybe Guelph follow in that example? And how did the idea exchange come about, and how does the province how did the province help out if the province helped out?
Well, I'd like to give a shout out to the Minister of Tourism, Culture and Sport, whose responsibility it is to look after libraries. And that's the Honorable Eleanor McMahon. So she's not far from Guelph either. And she looks after the Burlington riding. But it was really an initiative in the city. They were looking around at what else they could do to ensure that kids moving forward and really all adults and everybody in Cambridge could be up to date with today's best technology. So when the old post office came up, the city bought it. It's our only nationally designated building. And I thought, what can we do with this? So the Ideas Exchange board, as well as the city, did some consultation and thought, a digital library is really a forward-thinking way to help our community to address some of the challenges that we've got in the future with technology and IT tech. As you know, Waterloo Region, and including Guelph, is in that IT tech corridor between Waterloo Region, Guelph, and Toronto. So this was a way they wanted Cambridge residents to have what they need to look at what's ahead. And it's an exciting project. I had a tour about 6 weeks ago, and it's getting down to sort of the finishing strokes now. You can see the outline of the building, but it's going to have everything digitalized. There's an area for teens, an area for kids, but there's a huge part of that that's going to have some catering done for adults, not only programs and computers and all the other technologies, but there's also going to be a cafe in there, a reading room. And the view over the river is just spectacular. It's going to be one of the best views in the city. But the province is very keen to assist and look at projects that are forward-thinking and that are equipping today's working force with the tools that they need moving forward to address some of the challenges that some businesses have in finding the skills that they need.
I think I got distracted hearing so many people drooling.
They were, and they should. You should see it. It's incredible. So I believe that they're going to be opening this hopefully by spring.
Okay.
And so you can come and drool for sure on the building. Field trip. But you know what? I think that libraries are looking for ideas and ways to engage all of the community. It's interesting. My daughter, whenever she travels, she's in her early 30s now, and part of her role is to go to different areas in the States and recruit for U of T where she works.
Okay.
So not Guelph, but U of T. But well, nobody's when she's perfect, there, yeah. And she has a couple of days, the first thing that she goes into is the library. Because the library is what tells her what's on, what kind of cultural events there may be, a walking tour. Mm. But whatever time she goes, she starts not in the tourism necessarily because she doesn't have time for that, right. But at the library. So libraries are becoming a hub. They're the way they're what you can go to job search. Right. You can get hands-on assistance in learning how to use your computer if you don't have those skills. But it's also fun for the kids to go and do some interactive stuff. I think you'll be very amazed, and I'm quite sure that you will be looking at doing something similar once you see what it looks like here at University of Guelph, which is also a beautiful campus with lots of beautiful trees, I might add.
Yes, we do have the Arboretum. So
you do, yeah. I know. That was in my mind.
Trees are centric, as if they ever not, but that's fine. I do want to get to education things on a couple of fronts. I'll deal with this one first because it's kind of the more unpleasant. But the I know it's not your portfolio, but I imagine it's probably come up in caucus and cabinet a couple of times about what the strike at the Ontario colleges right now.
Yeah.
So I know that... negotiations started again today.
Yes,
I think there's
happily so.
Yes, I think there's some. I do know someone who's been affected by the strike, and she's hopeful that she might be able to go back to school next week. I'm not sure how ambitious that is, but from your end, has there been any talk about back to work legislation, or about any talk about maybe where that red line is, where you might have to make that kind of tough decision?
It's a good point, and I wanted to say first off that all of us are very concerned. Anytime anybody's out of a classroom, mm-hmm. it's concerning for us as a government and us as family members. You know, we all have students or are in school ourselves, and we know that families save to try and get their child to college. So this is distressing for everybody. There's been a lot of talk on all sides of the House, and we have strongly encouraged both sides to get back to the bargaining table. This is a bargaining collective, so government doesn't have a role.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they were out and starting the strike, we were already in those kinds of conversations well before the strike took place, and have strongly encouraged the sides to get back to the table. We have been discussing what our next steps as a government would be if they didn't get back to the table, and we were all very pleased that they did get back to the bargaining table today. From what I understand, the colleges have promised the students that they won't lose their year, and so that they will be trying to ensure that they will get the education that they are keen to get, and that the consequences of not getting back to the classroom soon end up potentially with more consequences the longer they're out. So
right.
I have spoken to many college students. My kids are this age, so some of their friends are out of school right now, but they're very hopeful to get back. Mm-hmm. I do understand that they are looking to ensure that the students don't lose their year, don't lose their semester, and are going through some ways of identifying that they can ensure that they get their year. But you are quite right. There's a lot of concern.
Yeah. I'll phrase it as a stroke of luck, although it wasn't really luck, but that one of the weeks that this has been affected is the college students have a reading week, so that was supposed to take place during one of the weeks the strike has been happening. So it's not quite that dire, but I think it's getting more dire as sort of this presses on.
Every day they go out, everyone's more concerned. I know Premier Wynne and Deb Matthews, who's the Minister of Advanced Education and Skills Development Ministry, have been very concerned, and both have been instrumental in talking to the two sides to get back to the table. I know the Premier has met with many student groups that have been coming in, as well as Minister Matthews.
Mm-hmm.
So we are very concerned, as they are, to ensure that they're back in the classroom just as soon as they can. So we're very hopeful today, as many people are, that the two sides can now settle and we can get back to the classroom.
Okay. Well, let's talk about something a bit more happy. I know that the premier introduced Bernie Sanders at an event at U of T this past weekend. Bernie Sanders, of course, very well known for his stand of free tuition. And I know Ontario's kind of leading that way. So, again, I know it's not your portfolio, but you did want to, you know, you and a lot of your colleagues are very proud of pushing this way. So in terms of maybe what the students out in the hallway maybe listening to this broadcast, you know, maybe what are they to look for in the coming months in terms of getting, you know, more access to education and not pushing their debt limit any higher?
This was a strong goal of our government's, and it may not be my portfolio, but if you look at the ages of all my children, you'd recognize that this was very close to my
heart. Are you saying this is a conflict of interest?
Not at all. Not at all. No, we are very keen. When Minister Matthews came into this ministry, she looked at all the programs that are out there for student assistance in financial aid, and she finally thought, is there a better way to deliver this? We listened to a lot of student groups. She did as well. She went out for consultation. So there's no new money in the financial aid program, but she rejigged everything. And the best thing that we could come up with and did come up with is free average tuition for about a third of our post-secondary education students across the province. That also includes mature students, which is very helpful. You know, when I go door-to-door as an MPP and talk about some of our government programs, all ages are affected by this. People that are considering going back to school, I met one mother that was on maternity leave. She said, this is a good time for me to kind of look at a change in career, which I'd been thinking about doing. Mm. And she, at the doorway, I pulled up the site, take out your pens or memorize this, students, ontario.ca/OSAP. So ontario.ca/OSAP. We did that calculation at her doorway because right on the front page is a calculator. She plugged in her financial numbers and she went, I'm eligible. Oh, this changes things. And it did. It told her what she would be eligible for in terms of loan and as well as grant. And she was average tuition. The other thing that we've done, two things. One, there are more online textbooks, and that has just started, and we'll be seeing increasing number of textbooks put to online, so that's a big savings with textbooks. And the next thing that we did was, we know it's difficult to come out of school and start trying to pay back the student loan if you haven't established yourself in your chosen pathway yet. So now a student has to be earning $35,000 per year or more to even start paying back the loan. Mm-hmm. So that should really assist people when they're doing their planning. This is a game changer. Minister Matthews was at a restaurant about 2 weeks ago in London where her riding is. And the server said to her, oh, are you Minister Matthews? I hate bothering you at dinner. And Minister Matthews, being who she is, said, not at all. Do you have a question? And she says, I just want to thank you. Mm-hmm. And the server burst into tears. Oh. And she said, my mom's a single mom. I've always wanted to be a doctor. We couldn't afford the education. And now I can realize my dream. I'm eligible and I'm going to school. So next they had to both have napkins to dry their eyes. Because it's those kinds of stories that we're hearing. I do door to door. People now don't self-select out of university. Yeah. If you can get the marks and you're motivated, financial issues are falling away. Mm-hmm. And we're finally able to afford to get people back to work. Why is that important for our economy? Mm-hmm. Ontario's economy right now, so everybody knows, is just cooking. We are the strongest economy in the G7 countries and the strongest or second strongest in Canada. And part of that is because of our focus on education. Mm-hmm. 20% more students are graduating now than they did in 2003. Mm-hmm. 68% to 87 or 88% of students graduate now. And we also have one of the highest per capita post-secondary education graduated students in the world. Mm-hmm. So what that does is allow businesses to come and invest in Ontario because they know they've got a talented group of students for their labor market. And we're still looking for some of those students. So we have focused on ensuring that our labor force is prepared for the jobs of the future. Companies such as Amazon are looking strongly at Ontario to coming in to ensure that they have a good, well-educated supply of people to come and work in their companies. Mm-hmm. So it is working, and we're delighted about this program. It is a game changer for people.
Yeah, that's a touching story about the waitress because, you know, I think a lot of people underestimate not just the difficulty in getting in. And the thing about the textbooks, I think, is so key because I remember my first year of university signing the tuition check, getting the standing in line, getting the student loans, and like, yes, it's paid for, ready to study. And then you go and you look at the textbooks.
And you go and buy your textbooks.
And then you're just, anyway.
No bugs for you.
But that's more coming. As I said, we started out with a few, but Minister Matthews said that they will be putting more and more textbooks online. So all of the costs that we used to associate with a post-secondary education, we're addressing bit by bit. And we've listened to students and tried to work it so that we can get the most bang for the buck.
And it's much easier to lug around an iPad than three textbooks.
Listen, as a provincial member MPP, I waived my first briefing book to go to AMO, Association of Municipalities of Ontario. I was a parliamentary assistant for the transportation, and that book
big
weighed
file.
8.5 pounds.
Oh, jeez.
So I also like the iPad to take
it,
away.
That's a sack of potatoes.
Yeah, it is. It's huge.
So you're still going door to door. I mean, I know the election isn't until next spring, but you're still doing that kind of, you know, shoe leather pavement kind of interactions with your constituents.
Well, to be honest, I've worn out a few shoes because I've never stopped going door to door. And I go there as a service to my constituents. Many people are maybe not reading media anymore and not aware of some of the government programs that we've got coming out. Even today, before I came here, I was doing door to door as an MPP saying, you know, here's, you know, we balanced our budget in the spring. We continue to invest in these programs. Many people didn't know about the free medication for anybody aged 24 years or younger starting January 1st. The OHIP Plus PharmaCare program.
That's right.
First PharmaCare program in Canada. And so I met at a door somebody that got a 20-year-old that needed medication, and they didn't know about the free OSAP.
Oh, wow.
So at the door, we saw two.
Two for one.
Yeah. Two for one. Yeah,
two for one.
So, as I said, I continue to go out as soon as I can to do that.
I only bring it up because I read an op-ed in The Record by Louisa D'Amato, and she was talking about the race for who's going to run for the Progressive Conservatives against you next spring.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about the rancor in that. Apparently, there's some of the politics that are going on in the PC party, but they mentioned. Or rather, the author mentioned that you must be dancing a jig every time you hear about this. So I'm wondering, do you indeed dance a jig when you hear about this struggle? And if not, how do you celebrate hearing about this? Maybe to set the record straight.
Yeah, well, that was a very interesting article. But, you know, to be honest, I just keep my head down as an MPP and try and do what I need to do for my constituents and also for my ministry. I know that Cambridge is the latest in a string of nomination issues that the PCs have faced, and I think that's why Ms. D'Amato was writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was the sixth issue that other ridings have faced. I mean, some
around.
Have quit outright. Some have
happened here.
Yeah, there's some legal challenges that the PC party are having to face over this. So Cambridge is the latest in a string. As I said, I will be running against somebody, likely from the NDP as well as the PCs. But for me, my focus is continuing to bring the issues from Cambridge and Waterloo Region to Queen's Park, but also to continue to resolving some of the issues that that I find when I'm speaking with and meeting with constituents.
And
so you're quite right. I am out there already, but always have been. And as I said, they will resolve it one way or another fairly soon, I think.
And I'll note it's a tough fight because you were the first Liberal in 70 years to be elected
right.
in Cambridge. So you're staying the course. And unfortunately, we have to wrap it up here. But Catherine McGee, Gary, thank you so much for joining us today. We really liked having you in, and maybe we'll have you in again soon, as they say.
Well, thank you, and I'll offer to have you for that tour for that Ideas Exchange Digital nice. Library.
I know
thank
about 36 people who will happily come along in that
we'll
van.
Hire a van.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I'll be there with you. So nice. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And we're going to have to wrap it up here for this week on Open Sources. We all have Council Leanne Piper in a couple of weeks on the November 13th show, and we're going to try and get some of the last counselors in for their yearly talk before we run out of time for the year. You can stay connected to us at Open Sources News Noir on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and on opensourcesguelph.com is our website. And, of course, you can find our podcast on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Me, you can find on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scott Hertzon Facebook, Scott Hertzon Twitter, and a blog, spannerbookwordpress.com.
Nailed it. DJ Sounds Good to Me will be here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and Open Sources will be back on your radio next Thursday at 5 p.m., and we'll see you then.